you make a distinction between kids when they're young, say in preschool or in elementary school, and they might notice race, but they don't necessarily group themselves by race. But once they reach adolescence, they often do. So what happens then? What happens in adolescence that causes kids to do that?
Well, certainly it is the case that young children, as you mentioned, notice physical differences. They notice them, they comment on them, they ask questions about them. Sometimes those questions don't get answered, and there is a section in my book that talks about how to discuss issues of race with young children. But fast forward to adolescence, puberty. As young people are starting to develop, not just physically, but cognitively, the brain changes in adolescence too, and they're better able to understand abstract concepts. As those things start to happen, young people across groups, doesn't matter what race they are starting to think about questions of identity. Who am I? Who will I be in the world? What will I do with myself? What do I want to be when I get older? All of those are identity questions. And to the extent that those questions are influenced by one's racial group membership, what opportunities will be available to me? Where will I live? Who will I go? Where will I go to school? All of those questions are determined to some degree by racial group membership still in the United States. And as young people become more aware of that because of the way people interact with them, for example, you know, a young African-American boy, 4 or 5 years old, might be perceived by many people as cute. But that same child, when he's 14, might be perceived by those same people as potentially dangerous. They're responding to him differently. And because of that social response, he's starting to wonder, well, what does my race mean in the world when I'm moving through department stores, when I'm on the street and I see a police officer approaching? What does that mean when I'm in school and decisions are being made about which group I should be in? Will I be in the advanced placement class, or will I be in the standard class or the remedial class? All of those things are often influenced in some way by one's racial group membership. There's lots of evidence to show that. So these are questions that start to emerge in adolescence. And because of that, you start to seek out people who are, whose experience is similar to yours. That's a short answer to what is a more complicated question. And of course, one of the reasons why I've written so much about it.
Yeah, I mean, so is it a healthy response then? Is it a self-protective response?
There is real value in gathering with people who have had shared experiences. We often take comfort in being surrounded with people who really know and understand who we are and what we're experiencing, and there is nothing wrong with that. What I often say when I'm in schools and teachers or principals ask the question of how do we get kids to interact, I often say let's pay less attention to who is sitting with whom at the lunch table and let's look at what's happening in the classroom. What are we doing to bring kids together? Are we giving them opportunities, for example, to work across lines of difference cooperatively? Do they have opportunities to engage in dialogue about important social issues in their social studies class, in their English class? Are we paying attention to how we are assigning children to groups? One of the things I didn't mention in a more explicit way I want to mention now is what sometimes is referred to as tracking. How children get assigned to ability groups in schools that are racially mixed often falls along racial lines. It is not uncommon to walk into a racially mixed school and find that the honors classes are almost entirely white, while the other classes are much more diverse, sometimes entirely made up of black and brown kids, if that's the demographic of the school. And we have to ask questions about why that is.
Yeah, that's very prevalent here in Seattle, and there are parents who are trying to change that, but it's been pernicious here, I would say. Do you go into this cultural stereotype that kids might absorb that you describe as a negative cultural stereotype, which is that performing well in school can be perceived as acting white? So how big a role is that in terms of how well black kids are doing in school?
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book when I'm describing this phenomenon known as so-called when kids tease each other, black children tease each other for, quote, acting white. And sometimes this can be found not just among African-American kids, but it can be among Latino kids sometimes or Native American kids. But that that phrase, acting white, varies in meaning depending on the school setting. For example, if you are in a largely black school where most of the kids are black and you are listening to a certain kind of music or dressing a certain way, your friends might tease you for, quote, acting white because they see you as taking on styles that are associated with the white population. But they might not necessarily tease you for acting white if you're doing well in school, because if you're in a largely black school, all the kids who are doing well are black kids. It's not necessarily seen as acting white. But if you are in a racially mixed school, the kind I just described, where all the honor students are white and the kids of color are tracked in lower groups, then if you become one of a handful of black kids in that honors class, your friends might say you're acting white. So it's important to understand the social context in which that language is being used. But when it is an issue, when it is a concern, you know, if you're a teenager, African-American teenager, trying to really figure out what does it mean to be a young black person in the 21st century in America, if I'm trying to really understand what my future is and how I think about myself, and the examples that are surrounding me of academic achievement are only white people, then I may start to feel like that is not an option for me. It's one of the reasons why I think role models are so important, because every young person wants to see themselves represented in positive ways. And when you do see those examples of academic achievement and you can say, that person did it, I can do it too, it inspires greater persistence in the face of academic challenge.
Can you talk about your own journey of developing racial identity? I mean, you grew up largely in a more white community. Is that right?
Absolutely. Almost entirely.
Oh, wow.
I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts called Bridgewater, Massachusetts. I was there because my father was an academic. He was a professor. He taught at Bridgewater State University. And in fact, my family moved there in 1958. My father was the first African-American professor at that institution. And for most of my educational experience, I was the only black kid in my class. So it was, you know, 99.9% white.
Whoa.
And certainly, however, in that environment, you know, growing up in the 60s and early 70s, I was very conscious of the fact that racism was an issue, not necessarily in my community, my small town, but in the wider society. I grew up just 30 miles from Boston. When I was in high school, there were riots happening in Boston between the white Irish families in South Boston not wanting to desegregate their schools, attacking buses of black children. We saw that on the news, not to mention all the stuff that was happening in the civil rights era across the nation. So certainly understanding that race was an issue in our society was part of my awareness. I went to college at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, and was very happy to find that that was a much more diverse community than the one I grew up in. And it was really the first opportunity I had to really sit at the table with the other black kids, because there were enough of us to be at a table. And I really relished and benefited from the affirmation I got in that community.
How did it help you?
Oh, it helped me a lot in terms of, you know, just helping me think about what it meant for me as a young African-American woman to imagine myself in the future, to have friends. I, of course, always had friends in high school and in, you know, elementary school, but those friends were white. This was my first opportunity to have friends who were African-American as I was, and I really appreciated that. We all want to be part of a larger community.
You write in the book that that African-American parents, when they are living in a predominantly white area, they should take steps to make sure that their kids do have friends of color. Do you feel like you got that when you were growing up?
I did to some extent. You know, my parents were from the South. My father grew up in Washington, D.C., and my mother grew up in Virginia, and they would regularly take us back to the D.C., Virginia area to visit relatives. I knew my cousins. You know, that was important to them. But I will say that sometimes the challenge is that the population's just not there. So in Bridgewater, you know, it was, you could count on probably a hand or two, the number of Black families living in that town. And one of the things I wrote about in an earlier book, that book is called Assimilation Blues, Black Families in a White Community, is that sometimes parents consider it important to create those opportunities for their young people, but sometimes the structure of where they live makes it difficult. There are some families, however, that don't consider it important at all. And one of the things that I've researched as a psychologist over the years of my career is whether it makes a difference. Does it matter to the young person whether their parents really seek out those social opportunities for them or not? And for the listeners in your audience, I would say it does matter that the young people who have those friendships within their community, whether that's in the next town or relatives or going to a church where they see themselves represented, often emerge as young adults with more confidence in their sense of self than those who don't.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. You devote part of your book to whiteness and describe what white people can do to stop ignoring race and instead understand it and then hopefully work against racism. So, but one thing you wrote that I was like underlining and drawing stars next to is that white people should achieve a healthy sense of white identity. I think in this day and age when we have white supremacists marching, that's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
Yes. Well, I really hope that, again, your audience will take the time to read this section because it is important to understand that it is possible. It is possible to have a positive sense of your white identity without an assumed sense of superiority or perceiving other people as inferior. So when we acknowledge that a dimension of our identity is important, we live in a race-conscious society. Whether you identify as white or as a person of color, it does make a difference in terms of how other people perceive you and respond to you. That's just a fact. We need to acknowledge that. But you can also acknowledge that there are ways to be part of a multiracial, multicultural community in which everyone's identity matters. Everyone's identity can be a positive thing. And part of learning how to engage effectively across lines of difference is learning how to be what I would call an ally, learning how to use the advantage that is built into the system in such a way to interrupt the cycle of racism in our society. There are ways that we can bring about change. And historically, if we look over our history, we know that there has been social change. And that change has not just been driven by people of color. It has also been driven by white people who have said, I want to live in a more equitable society. How can I make that happen? And that is the work that we can do together.
What do you think white people should do to have less homogeneous social networks? I mean, one statistic that you cite is that I think it was 75% of whites have entirely white social networks, and that's much more homogeneous than African Americans or Hispanic people. So what can white people do to break out of that?
It's a great question, and I want to lift up a couple of examples that are in the last section of my book. They're the last epilogue, it's called, is titled Signs of Hope, Sites of Progress. And one of the examples I mention is something that has actually taken place in the city where I live, the Atlanta Friendship Initiative. And this was an initiative launched by a white businessman who decided he wanted to expand his social network as a way of helping to break down racial barriers. And he reached out to another businessman he knew, happened to be someone African-American. He was quite intentional in choosing an African-American person, invited that man to have lunch with him, and over lunch talked about how he wanted to create opportunities for people to cross these racial barriers that are sometimes part of our daily lives by initiating a friendship with that man and then inviting that man to help him bring other people together in pairs. And that is what they have done. So for this initiative was launched in the fall of 2016, but basically it involves people being paired up with someone they don't know across racial lines of difference and then inviting those people who agree to meet once a quarter over lunch or breakfast or to do something together where they're getting to know each other as a way of simply expanding their understanding of somebody else's lived experience in the city. And it's been quite interesting to see how people have really responded quite enthusiastically about this opportunity. And what I liked about it, and one of the reasons I included it in the book, is because it was such a simple thing. It didn't require a big budget. It didn't require legislation. It was something that someone said, I want to do this and see if I can get other people to do it with me. And lo and behold, that's working. And other cities have been reaching out to the and reading information on the website. It's called AtlantaFriendshipInitiative.com if you want more information to find out how such an initiative might happen in your community. The main thing I would say, though, is that we all have to be willing, particularly if you are in the advantaged position, if you're in the dominant position relative to racism, being willing to risk some discomfort. You know, maybe going to visit a black church that you have not attended before is a perfectly fine experience to have. And most people I know who've done that will come back saying they really enjoyed the experience and want to go back again sometime. Putting yourself in meetings where you might find yourself in the minority as opposed to always being in the majority. Those are steps that people can take. And there are organizations like Showing Up for Racial Justice, known as SURJ, S-U-R-J, where white people get together and talk about how they can be better allies to people who are being impacted every day by racism in our society.
I think white people might feel hesitant to just show up at a black church. That they might feel like they're, you know, that the congregation might not want them there.
That's a very common feeling. When I was teaching my class, I taught a class for many years earlier in my career called The Psychology of Racism. And I taught at a majority white institution, and I taught at Mount Holyoke College, and I asked my students to go somewhere where they would find themselves in the minority. And it's hard to do that if you live in a largely white community. And so for many of them, the best choice was to visit a church in a neighboring city, Springfield, Massachusetts. And the students would often write essays about their experience, and they often talked about how nervous they were. And if you think about that, you know, recent circumstances, recent violence notwithstanding in terms of these recent shootings, churches typically are pretty safe places. So if you might be hesitant to enter into an unfamiliar space, but always, without exception, they came back from that experience saying they were warmly greeted, they really enjoyed the service, even if they weren't Christians. Sometimes they were of another faith tradition, maybe Jewish, and found that it was a very warm and embracing experience. So, yes, people are nervous, but I think it's important for white people to think about how often they expect people of color to come into their spaces where they are in the minority, and no one says, oh, you must be nervous about that. They just say, you must come. And so I think it's important for white people to be willing to risk some discomfort, knowing that they'll learn something from the experience.
That's interesting. One thing that I've been wondering about is residential segregation. And say you're a white family that wants to live in a more racially mixed neighborhood, but then you risk, you know, being perceived as contributing to gentrification. So what's the answer there?
Well, that's a complicated question because we know that gentrification is a problem. And certainly if you're an African-American person living in an African-American community, And then when white people start to move in, if what often happens, property values start to rise as more investment is made in the community because of the growing white population. Ironically, resources tend to follow white people. That's part of the system of advantage. And when that starts to happen, property values go up, taxes rise, and it becomes rents rise, and it becomes less affordable for the people who've been living there all along. That is a dilemma. But it is possible to often when that's happening, you have middle-income people moving into low-income areas. And it's the fact that the middle-income people are coming in and can pay higher rates that are driving the costs up for the low-income folks. But there are certainly middle-income neighborhoods that are largely made up of African-Americans or people of color. Certainly that's true in Atlanta, and I imagine that might be true in Seattle. I don't know. And the and so making a choice as to live in a neighborhood where that is racially mixed, it is possible to do that without gentrification. That is possible. But the other side is possible, too, which is to say, if you're in a largely white neighborhood, you can recruit people of color into your neighborhood. And, you know, a house is for sale. You know a family of color. You might say, think about moving into my neighborhood. And then don't move away, right? When we look at how racially mixed neighborhoods change, it is typically because people of color are moving in and white people then start to move out. That's the challenge historically. And I think that if we understand the patterns of residential segregation, we can address that without gentrification being the ultimate result.
Okay, that's useful information. You have revised this book for the 20th anniversary edition, and you've addressed the question, have things gotten better? And sounds like your conclusion is not yet, but you remain hopeful. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, when I started working on the book, many people asked me two questions. Are the black kids still sitting together in the cafeteria? And the answer to that question in most places is yes. And then the next question would be, well, isn't anything better? And I think whether you think of our society as having gotten better may depend on how old you are. You know, if you were born in the 50s, as I was, and if you think about race relations in the 50s and Jim Crow, the Jim Crow South, and, you know, limited access to voting until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, all of those things we can point to and say, that's better. I was talking just today with a gentleman who grew up in the South, and he's the same age as me, born in the 50s. He said, you know, I remember those whites-only signs. You know, those are gone. Those things are better. That said, if you were born in 1997, if you are a child of the 21st century, you don't have those experiences to draw back, to look back on. That's ancient history. You might not even know that history. But if you were born in 1997, you were 4 years old in 2001 when 9/11 happened. You've come of age in a post-9/11 era. And all the concern about people outside the, you know, concern about immigrants and concern about anti-Muslim rhetoric, for example, all that has been post-9/11. That's been part of your growing up experience. And so in 2008, now you're 11 years old, the economy is tanking, the Great Recession is well underway, economic anxiety has been introduced into your family in a way that maybe it wasn't existing in for an earlier generation. In the same year, 2008, President Obama is elected for the first time. And for many people, that's a significant milestone because it symbolically indicated progress. The U.S. elected its first African-American president. And yet, following his election, we know that there was a backlash that has included rise in hate crime activity, rise in hate group participation, the increased visibility of white supremacist groups. And we also know that just even though there was a lot of conversation about a post-racial America following his election in 2008, in 2012 was the shooting of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman, and the followed rapidly by shootings of unarmed black men at the hands of police. In 2014, the shooting of Michael Brown and the Ferguson uprising, all of these things happening at the height of your adolescence. If you were born in 1997, you would have been 15 in 2012 when Trayvon Martin was killed. You would have been 17 when Michael Brown and Ferguson happened. And you would be 19 in 2016 when the election was taking place, the presidential election, with all that divisive language and rhetoric. Fast forward to the summer of 2017, maybe you're just turning 20 when Charlottesville is happening. And if you think about all of those incidents compressed into the adolescence of a young person today, it would be hard for that young person to say things have gotten better.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, well, the way you list it, it's just like one after another, one thing after another.
Yes, and so that's why I say, you know, is change possible? Absolutely. You know, certainly there's been change in my lifetime, but progress is rarely linear. It's often two steps forward, one step back. And I think if we look at it through the eyes of a 20-year-old today, we can see a lot of backward motion. Is it possible for us to move forward again? Absolutely. And that's why I maintain my optimism, and one of the reasons why in the book I wanted to lift up those signs of hope and sights of progress at the end, because each of us has the opportunity to make a difference. We all have spheres of influence. And if we are using our sphere of influence to bring about positive social change, then it can happen.
Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum is president emerita of Spelman College, a historically black college for women in Atlanta, and is a psychologist. She's published a new 20th anniversary edition of her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.